In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, glory to Jesus Christ.
Glory to God forever.
This week we had some prominent female saints on our calendar. On Thursday we had St. Anna, the mother of the Theotokos, and we had St. Olympias, the deaconess. And today we read the story of the Gadarene swine. And it might seem like a stretch to put those two together, but here we go. And I'm going to tell you the story of how the Gadarene swine saved my bacon when I first came into the church, and I was caught between feminist ideology and the patriarchy. A long time ago, back in 2008, when I came into the church, I was in graduate school, and I was learning how to teach writing, and I was learning how to teach a specific group of people how to write. I was learning how to teach non-traditional students, so that's students that usually are coming into the college setting a little bit later, and they were minorities, and they were mostly women. And the women I was working with struggle with writing process in a particular way. They have a writer's block that usually stems from not feeling like they have a place to speak, not knowing what to say, not feeling like they know what is expected in writing in an academic or a professional setting. So their writing process is usually stopped before it even starts. Now, usually it's not helpful. Well, we don't like to categorize people and start drawing conclusions from them, right? That's what we call stereotypes, and nobody likes a stereotype. But for these women, it was really useful to know that they had particular problems that were different from other groups that I had taught, men, younger students, for instance. And because I was studying them as a group, I was really immersed in feminist writing process theory, which is actually a discipline of its own, if you didn't know that. With that comes a lot of suspicion of tradition. There's a lot of progressive thinking. There's a lot of affection for rational thought and thinking that the way that we used to do things is a little embarrassing, and definitely we do it better now, and we're getting better all the time, and that tradition is just suspect and ignorant and darkness. And so I was immersed in this world of feminism and progressivism and academic rational values when along comes orthodoxy. And with what everyone in my academic world called patriarchy, with a little p, not the big patriarchs, I've never met one of those, but the patriarchy and tradition. And at Annunciation, our previous parish, women in head coverings and skirts, very traditional all-male clergy. And everything that I was taught was the bad old days. And if you know me, you might know that I have a little honor streak. So when you tell me something is true, my knee-jerk reaction is start poking at it to see where you're wrong. So I was sitting in a feminist writing process theory class and getting an earful of why Christianity was yesterday's news. And I thought, what if there's something to this Orthodox Church? Like, wouldn't it be wild if I just started going there? And I wasn't wrong. It was a wild experience for me at that time. Because what I found on coming into the church was not just the love and the joy and the peace that we experience here every Sunday, it was a whole lot of headaches for someone who's immersed in the academic world. For one thing, I learned that Orthodoxy has a really robust academic tradition of its own. It's not impoverished in rational thinking, and it's not backwards in terms of education. And in fact, a lot of modern saints have been extremely well-educated. Metropolitan Anthony Bloom was a surgeon. St. Nikolai Velimirovich had 2 doctorates and spoke 7 languages. So smarter people than me had been Orthodox and had even been saints. So the defense that tradition was old and backwards and dusty and ragged and just something to throw out kind of fell apart really quickly. So I went to my classes where people assumed that all of this feminist ideology was the objective truth of reality, and Christianity was just dated and problematic. And I went to church where women wore skirts and head coverings, and the clergy were all men, and there was even the rumor that girls were not allowed in the altar. And wherever I went, I immediately felt, this is awkward. This is so awkward. Now, honestly, it was more than awkward. At times, it was even a little bit painful. Because at first glance, the church does have kind of a masculine face, right? Like, I can't argue that it doesn't. The Bible was written by guys. Liturgical hymnography is often pretty rough on Eve and on women. And I read the other day, I was reading a great article about Orthodoxy in the US and the fact that in the Orthodox Church in the US, it's the only church that has men and women in equal proportion. All the other churches, more women than men. And this article also talked to a bunch of recent converts, which a lot of them were men. And it highlighted the reasons why they had been attracted to the Orthodox Church in the first place. And what they said was they liked that metaphors in the church are athletic or military. They liked that the faith is action-oriented. And they liked that the leadership is male. And they like it that there are a lot of beards. That's a direct quote. So coming into the church as a woman with my background, I really struggled hard with this for a few years. And it didn't get in the way of me joining the church, but it definitely went on the list of issues that Jesus and I have with each other that I assume I'm going to come around on eventually, but it caused a lot of hard feelings for a while. So a strength that women writers do have is asking questions, because in our culture, a lot of times men are kind of expected to have all the answers, and women have a little more leeway when it comes to asking questions. So I did what I do, I started poking, and I asked questions. And I'm going to share with you a couple of things that I found when I went looking for where women fit into the Orthodox Church. I'm going to start with the obvious one, which is that I'm standing here giving you a homily right now. Because a very favorite proof text of people who think that women should have a less prominent role in the church is 1 Corinthians, where Paul says, "I don't permit a woman to teach." Now, Orthodox people don't do a lot of proof texting because we consider that kind of sloppy exegesis, right? We want to put that with the whole body of tradition and not select verses out of context. And when you do that, you find that in this same letter, St. Paul actually talks about female prophets. So obviously he was not telling them to shut up. And then he also later commends St. Junia for her work with him in spreading the gospel. And St. Junia is commemorated by the church with St. Mary Magdalene as equals to the apostles for spreading the word of Christ. And also St. Olympias, the deaconess, who I mentioned in the beginning, right? We had deaconesses at one time. We even have a few deaconesses now. What about women not being allowed in the altar? Well, before I was married, I spent some time at St. John the Forerunner Monastery in Goldendale, Washington. It's a Greek monastery, Greek women's monastery. And that was really all I needed to put that one to rest. Because if you go to a women's monastery, you're going to see women serving in the altar. The abbess can give blessings just like a priest can. In fact, a priest has to have a blessing to do liturgy in her home monastery. The bishop can bless her to distribute the holy gifts to her nuns if it's necessary, and she can hear confessions. Also, at our previous parish, I was in charge of keeping vestments clean and altar articles and making sure that the altar was well supplied and stocked, so I spent a fair amount of time in there myself. Now, I don't know if anybody ever added up demographics between male and female saints, but I'm willing to bet they're probably about the same. But then there's the commander-in-chief of all of them, and I use that title on purpose because one of the titles of the Theotokos is champion leader. In the Western Christian tradition that I grew up in, Mary is a little bit of a wallflower. In the East, we don't really have that view of her at all. In fact, the Greek for champion leader is, I'm going to butcher this, I don't speak Greek at all, Ipomako Stratego. A Greek-speaking friend told me that that actually translates as mighty general. This is not very wallflowerish. You may find some scathing quotes in patristic writings that seem to denigrate women, but if you look to the heavies in the church, like St. Basil the Great or St. Gregory Nazianzen, you're going to find something different. And St. Basil says this, "Women are taken from the same matter as men. We were created in the image of God like them. Like the masculine sex, the feminine sex is capable of virtue, and this by the will of the Creator." St. Gregory says this, There is only one creator of man and of woman, one dust from which both have come, one image of God, one law, one death, and one resurrection. Now here at Holy Trinity, I see a lot of gender harmony in action to the point that I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. I see men and women serving at coffee hour, even though there's only ladies on the roster. I see men and women mowing the lawn. I see men and women working at Cheese Days and at the Harvest Festival. And I see men and women equally participating in liturgy. Now, Christ told us that to attain leadership in the kingdom of heaven, we become servants. And I would say that here, I'm seeing a lot of people doing really well. So what does this all have to do with the Gadarene swine? Because I told you that they solved this problem for me. Well, when people start talking about gender or categories of any kind, you can kind of get into this back and forth. Like, I just basically gave you a list of girls can do that too, and they can do it in church. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you. And it's like not really helpful, right? We just do get this back and forth. Enter today's gospel reading. When Metropolitan Anthony Bloom, that smart Orthodox surgeon that I told you about earlier, homilized on this passage, he focused on one thing, and that was that Jesus, when he was confronted with the possessed man, now in St. Matthew's gospel that you read today, it's two, but in Mark and Luke, it's one. When he saw this possessed man, he dropped everything and put all of his attention on this one man. And he says this, "And here, Christ, God of the universe, as if forgetting everything in the world, focuses all his attention on this man, because this man is suffering, because he needs help, because he is in grief. It is worth thinking about this, because we do not behave thus with people in need." Sometimes we minimize the sufferings of one person. It's easy to get worked up about the war in Ukraine or in Gaza or about worldwide hunger. It's even easy to minimize our own problems. I do this myself. I think God has got everyone to pay attention to. Like, I don't have problems, right? But this gospel passage shows us that Jesus doesn't really operate like that. When Jesus sees a problem, he cares deeply about each individual person, which brings me back to the problem of categorizing and generalizing. It's very helpful to have in mind the differences between groups. When I went to attack problems with students that I was teaching to write in the community college, it was very helpful to know that those women's problems were different from the problems of other students that I had taught. And it's helpful to know that the church views men and women differently, even though clearly it honors them the same. Because in our world, that's going to come up. It's going to be important to know. But it's absolutely critical that we also remember that God is not the God of categories and big groups of people. He knows us as individuals. To him, we aren't men and women, clergy and laity, monks and people in the world. We are Annie and Timothy and Lori. And where's Monk Mark? Monk Mark. I don't know, for some reason your name came to mind and I put it in my sermon, so it's right there, I have to read it. Anyway, when we don't approach each other that way, we're robbed of an authentic encounter with each other because it's an illusion to see one characteristic over another. What's important for an authentic encounter is that, like Jesus did, I stop and I join and I accept you and I'm with you. The reading from Romans today touches on that too. God does not preside at a distance over groups or categories of people. St. Paul tells us the word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart, the word of faith, which is Christ. Tennyson put it like this, "Christ is closer to us than breathing, nearer than hands and feet, as nearer than any perceived membership in a group." But when I was getting through this awkward time trying to sort out where I belonged between the academic world that was telling me one thing and the church that was telling me something else, the only helpful thing that anyone ever told me was this: that God didn't care about me being a woman or even what the church said about that or what the world was telling me about that. He saw me, just me, and he knew me better than I knew myself. That was the only thing that gave me peace. And this can be useful for anyone because the world is always trying to put you in a box. And God does not need the boxes because he sees you. Our calling is to be who God made us to be, not to support the expectations the world or even the church has for us. Our calling is to listen to the word Christ in our hearts and to do what he tells us. Anything else is a tragic distraction from the real life that he has for us. We don't need to worry about where we fit in the church or anywhere else because Christ puts us where we belong. And that's where we fit, regardless of what anybody else thinks. There's only one you, and he needs you to be that, regardless of any distractions or limitations from outside or from inside.